When your battery goes dead, everything can come to a stop. Don't take a chance on getting stranded. Stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts and get your battery tested free of charge. If your battery does need to be replaced, O'Reilly Auto Parts can help you find the exact Superstart battery that fits your car or truck at a guaranteed low price. O'Reilly Auto Parts. Better parts, better prices every day.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
You're listening to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.
Welcome to Full Power Living, the only show on international media that's dedicated to the exploration and understanding of emotions and their role in human life. I'm Eileen Dillon, your creator and host, and during this broadcast, we invite you to interact with us on our chat here on the emotionalpro.com radio page or the blogtalkradio.com/FPL page. That's FPL for Full Power Living. Also, you can call us, and please do call us, on our toll-free number, 800-630-7858. Right now, indigenous peoples in the Amazon jungle awaken daily, sit together around a communal fire and discuss their dreams, sing and talk together while drinking the ceremonial Wayusa tea, which can help them be runa, that is, fully human. Throughout the history of humanity, people have gathered together to discuss what they believe, the myths their ancestors taught them, and what's happening in their daily lives. When's the last time you gathered around the communal fire to talk about cultural myths? Hidden deep in our psyche are myths laid on top of myths, ideas and perceptions and hidden memories from generations past that have been passed on to us that most likely are totally hidden from us, and yet they're having an influence on how we perceive our world, the actions we take, and the things that are important to us. So if we look at what is happening in our lives, we may know them better. Our guest today has written a fascinating book, Madness at the Gates of the City, The Myth of American Innocence, in which he attempts to uncover the myths that underlie our American culture and show their impact on our daily and national lives. Barry Spector writes about American history and politics from the perspective of myth, indigenous traditions, and archetypal psychology. He's been published multiple times in the Jung Journal, and his book is Madness at the Gates of the City, The Myth of American Innocence, for which he won the 2011 Penn Oakland Josephine Miles Literary Award. He also has participated in the Mythopoetic Men's Movement for over 20 years. He's a staff member with the Redwood Men's Center in Santa Rosa, California, where men come together in community to express and explore ideas that restore wholeness to themselves and soul to the world. He and his wife, Maya, have worked with men and women to heal the gaps and wounds between the genders, and they do oral traditions, poetry salons, and an annual Day of the Dead with grief rituals. And they're hoping that this and other similar rituals will eventually serve as models for larger scale events that may influence American culture at a deeper level. So, Barry Spector, welcome to Full Power Living.
My pleasure, and thanks for the wonderful introduction.
Well, a large part of your message, as I read it, is that we Americans have lost contact with our full selves because we've lost contact with the myths that are part of our psyche, and those are inside running us without our knowledge. And that you hope that you can help us uncover and look at the myths so we can discover better who we are and then come to be more fully conscious and deliberate and take more charge of our human experience. That's my attempt to summarize that incredible book you've written.
Thank you. I really liked that little anecdote you started out with about the indigenous people in South America getting together in the morning to was it they were discussing their dreams? Is that what they were doing?
Yes. Our daughter actually works for Pachamama in Ecuador.
Okay.
So this is how I have learned of that.
Well, maybe that's a good place to start off the conversation with.
Okay.
What I'd like to suggest is that we have to have a big imagination, both about the past and about the future, because I really feel that our contemporary conventional political and economic and religious, and to a great extent even psychological, leaders have failed us. We're in a very tragic state in modern culture, and I want to draw a kind of a imaginative distinction between who we are now and perhaps the people that you were describing in South America. What I like to think of as myth and mythology brings us back to indigenous cultures and to ancient cultures also in the West. And in this imagination, myth held people together, gave them meaning, connected them in a profound and practical way to the recurrent cycles of nature and the great cosmic cycles as well, and connected people to their souls and to the unique purpose with which each individual comes into the world. And now our greatest teacher of mythology was Joseph Campbell, and he suggested that we've been living in what he called a demythologized world since about the 12th century. I propose that it's been a much longer process, that the breakdown of myth has been going on for a very long time. And instead of what I call the creative imagination with which indigenous people dwelled in their worlds of myth and ritual, I believe what we have now is a breakdown we've had for a long time, not just as Americans, but our European ancestors for many centuries. We've been living in this demythologized world, and I feel that instead of the creative imagination, what we have has been broken down into two things. One I call the predatory imagination, and the other I call the paranoid imagination. And the predatory imagination is characterized very simply by an absolutely unquenchable desire for power. And the paranoid imagination is characterized by a constant fear and anxiety. And so as modern people, we are alienated. We experience alienation as a result of having lost our connection to our deep myths.
Well, certainly what we're seeing in our culture would support that. Now, I just want to say that your book is rich and very thorough, and I want to put this proviso that I'm going to be asking you questions and they're only going to scratch the surface.
I understand. Well, maybe it'll be the beginning of a longer conversation.
Okay, so in the absence of myth or in demythologized societies, people develop the predatory or the paranoid ways of looking at things.
I think so.
What you spend a good part of the first part of the book talking about different myths, especially regarding
Dionysus.
And you also talk about initiation. So ideally, what would myth and initiation do in a culture that would not lead us to predatory and paranoid ways of relating?
Well, you know, there are a few vestigial places in the world and a few indigenous cultures where we can get a hint of what that is like. You know, we've lost it for so long that we can't even really remember how much what we've actually lost. But as I said earlier, I think a living mythology and the rituals associated with it connect to the notion of initiation in very deep and practical terms. I mean, in indigenous culture, you could suggest that there's not nearly as much the kind of diversity as we experience as modern people. People look and dress relatively similarly, and their belief systems can remain relatively unchanged over long periods of time. But I think if you scratch below the surface and you look at the stories that they tell each other, and I keep things really simply, although academics can go to very great lengths to define what myth and mythology is, I keep it very simple. To me, myths are the stories that we tell ourselves about ourselves. And I think indigenous people had the ability that to have a tremendously creative imagination, and that's expressed in their stories and in their imagination of the possible. And what that means in terms of initiation, and that's a huge subject, of course. We could spend the whole hour just speaking about that one subject. Is that when each new generation comes of age, they are they become adolescents in the sense that troublesome, worried, anxious adolescents are in every culture. But they enter, they live in a culture where the elders know that it's going to happen and expect it to happen, and in fact look forward for it to happening, because they know that each generation, each individual in each new generation has something absolutely critically important, a critically important gift to deliver to the community, without which the community can't really go on living. And so they value each individual child. In indigenous initiations, the hope is that everyone will succeed in the initiatory trials. As opposed to modern culture, where what little vestiges of initiation we have, we see in bar mitzvahs or baptisms or fraternity initiations or the professional exams that people take to get their MAs and PhDs. And the whole purpose of these exams, of course, is to minimize who succeeds. And to rather than inviting the whole new generation to give their gift to the world, so we have our myths and initiations, so to speak, in modern culture. But they are just somebody coined a wonderful term that they used the phrase the toxic mimic. Are the stories that we tell ourselves now, and the kind of rituals that we have as modern people, are the toxic mimics, you could say, of the real thing.
For example, what would be a toxic mimic?
Well, most tragically, in modern culture, there are tens of thousands of young men. In Los Angeles alone, has tens of thousands of young men who are drawn into the gang culture, and the gang cultures do have initiations, and they do have a kind of mythology that they have. But unfortunately, it's a mythology that leads men toward death, not toward life. And on a much grander scale, on a much more tragic scale, you couldn't have modern war. You couldn't have armies of millions of young men unless you had a desperate desire for some kind of deep meaning and great cosmic goal to give their lives to, unless you without the kind of modern initiations that we have in the army as well. So I think these are the worst examples of the toxic mimics of the initiation traditions of modern culture. I mean, modern men are drawn into armies by the tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands and millions, but they don't come home. They aren't returned to their communities with a gift. If anything, they come home shattered and alienated and depressed.
Well, now that brings up, in your book you talk about there are certain, I think there are about four things that identify a ritual, like taking the person out of the culture and, as you say, coming back with a gift. Will you tell us what those steps are?
Well, it's not so much steps, but that's an excellent jumping off to a really important theme for our conversation and in my book. Again, looking back at Joseph Campbell, what he wrote about in his most famous book, The Hero with a Thousand Faces, is something that he called the monomyth, in which was the basic story of the hero that he found in every culture across the earth. And in that story, although there were thousands of variations, the essence of it can be clearly reduced down to what you're asking, to three steps. What he saw in all of these stories all across culture is that whatever the story is, it begins with it's typically a young man who is part of a community who, for some reason, feels a call, and he has to go out and leave his community and go out into the world. And it's a world, it's often a dark forest or the ocean or the desert. It's someplace full of dangers, and he is confronted with tremendously difficult tasks, often symbolized by, you know, say, for example, fighting a dragon or achieving, you know, the golden fleece or finding a treasure of great value or whatever. And often he will meet a mysterious young woman and marry her, and this is the second phase. And now the third phase, which is equally important, is that he returns to his community with his gift and bestows it upon the world. And the story of Christ, the story of Buddha, are essentially our greatest examples of this three-part hero's myth story. Now, what Campbell noticed is that when we speak in anthropological terms, was that his hero myth was a direct parallel to what anthropologists call the three-part sequence of initiation, where in indigenous cultures, the young men are taken often quite abruptly and under great duress. They're taken away from their community. They have to live out in the wilderness among with the elders. But that wilderness symbolizes what we call liminality, the period in between, the betwixt and between. And the young men are forced to undergo great trials, which are indeed symbolic of the trials of their changing psyche. And then when they complete the initiation, and again, this is very important, the third part is when they return to the community and are welcomed by the entire community as men. Now, to go back to Joseph Campbell, second, what he noticed, as I said, was the hero myth everywhere across the world in all indigenous cultures, with one exception, and that's modern culture. And what I have suggested in my book is that in America, due to the very unique characteristics of our history and our geography and the meeting of European culture with the indigenous cultures, we developed a kind of a hero myth in America, but it was fundamentally extremely different from the hero myths found in all indigenous cultures. And I don't know if you want to get into that at this point, or we can speak about it later in the hour. But the American hero myth is significantly, fundamentally different from those stories found everywhere across the rest of the world.
I think it's appropriate for us to hear what those fundamental differences are right now.
Okay.
Tell us.
Well, in America, what happened within just the two or three generations of the European conquest of America, and I may find myself lapsing into the word "we," but I hope your listeners will know that I'm putting quotes around the word "we." What I'm really speaking of is our white European ancestors. When we arrived on these shores, of course, you know, at this point we have to begin to acknowledge our history and the genocide of the native peoples and the importation of millions of African slaves. What they encountered very early on were people who were so other, so different from them, that they had to demonize them because, you know, let's face it, they were conquering them. And in order to live with the facts, with these facts, that they within just a few generations, they created this, the beginning of what I call the myth of American innocence. And this can be told in a very, in its essence, in a very quickly. What you have in the American story, repeated tens of thousands of times throughout the 18th, 19th, and 20th, and right into the 21st centuries, is a story of a pure innocent community, which is under attack. Or danger or threat by these dark, savage, mysterious, demonized people coming out of the dark forest and attacking for no reason whatsoever. So in other words, those who were actually conquering the land within a few generations managed to invert the guilt of history and see themselves as the victims. And so they were victims of these savages, and the only way they were saved was by the sudden appearance of an enigmatic lone stranger from the outside, the American hero, who would ride in and defeat the threat with biblical fury and savagery and violence. And then, this is the most important part of the story. If you know your film history, I would suggest you think of the film Shane from 1953.
Mm-hmm.
When the hero, once he finishes his work, quite literally leaves the beautiful woman with whom he might have settled down and rides off into the sunset. And so this is our American hero. And the story had already been deeply ingrained in the American psyche long before 1953. It had been told, in, as I said, in thousands of variations ever since the late 16 and early 1700s. But this is the American story. The American hero, instead of coming from the community suffering into experience and losing his own innocence, and giving his gift to the community, he comes from outside, he saves the innocent community, restores innocence, and then leaves. And this is the basis of American masculinity that we've been modeling on for 15 to 20 generations. And in the last century, of course, we've been displaying it to the world, with especially in our movies, so that the American... the American hero has become the world hero in the last 100 years because of the spread of our pop culture.
Mm. Well, there's, I found this with your book, too. There's just so much to get your head around. And I find it interesting, and I know you pointed it out, that on the one hand, we have demonized the other, but on the other hand, this hero that comes in is also an other, not one of us, but we don't demonize them. We're up to our first break, Barry. We're talking today with author and ritualist Barry Spector, whose book is Madness at the Gates of the City, The Myth of American Innocence. Coming up next, we're going to look at issues of violence, race, and the way we treat our children. We'll be right back.
Power Living with Eileen Dillon.
How difficult is it for you to ask directly for what you really want? To take responsibility graciously and willingly for your mistakes? Or to relate with others because it's fun instead of because you need something from them? Most people believe manipulation and codependence are normal behaviors for adults. They may be common, but they're not normal. Manipulative behaviors really are designed to be part of childhood, to be put away as things of the past when we become adults. So, if you're ready to let manipulation and codependence be part of your past, then get the mini course I've created for you, Ending Codependence, The Bottom Line. I'm Eileen Dillon, the Emotional Pro, offering you a formula that you can follow for creating healthy, manipulation-free, and lasting intimate relationships. I also give you the tools and principles that you can use to develop lasting immunity to codependence. Get Ending Codependence today at www.emotionalpro.com. That's emotionalpro.com. All right, welcome back to Full Power Living. I have a few announcements. Next week, March 15th, Alan Locos will be discussing patience, the art of peaceful living, with us. He offers a roadmap for creating greater patience in our lives. This is something I can use. You can find our upcoming guests listed at the top of our radio show page on emotionalpro.com, and we hope you don't miss a single episode of Full Power Living. Be aware, too, that we have a toll-free number, 800-630-7858, and we also have chats on emotionalpro.com on the radio page or at blogtalkradio.com/FPL. And in the future, if you miss us live or you want to share our show with your friends and family, download archive podcasts or subscribe on iTunes to Full Power Living. We certainly appreciate you're helping us with our mission of transforming our world through the mastery and power of human emotions. Now, today we're talking with Barry Spector, who's an author, researcher, and ritual leader, about his book, or ideas from his book, and things that he's working on in his life, Madness at the Gates of the City, The Myth of American Innocence. You can find him on the web at Barry and Maya Spector, BarryandMayaSpector.com. And Barry, before we go further, where can people find a copy of your book?
Well, let me also mention, thank you, the book actually has its own website. It is madnessatthegates.com. It is found in most, hopefully most bookstores. You can certainly get it on Amazon. It's available also on Kindle, and very soon it's going to be available on iPad.
Great. All right. There's so much here. It's hard to even dive in. So let me go.
Well, I have an idea where we could dive next, unless
okay.
You're going to.
Go for it.
I really liked your PR spot about emotions, and I think what I've been saying so far can sound rather abstract, but it's important to bring these issues down into our personal lives and speak about the impact of our myths on our emotional lives. So we could certainly go in that direction if you like.
Let's do it. Go for it.
Okay. Let me give a little background. I've been studying Greek mythology for 20 years, and early on, I think I was blessed to realize that these are not simply old stories that are of interest to students of literature. They have really profound significance for who we are as modern people, in terms of what they have to say about human nature itself and human emotion. And in particular, I began to 10, 12, 15 years ago, I began to study the myths about the Greek god Dionysus, who, if you know a little bit about Greek myth, you know that he was the god of the vine, of wine, of drunkenness. But that really is just a very superficial understanding. He's also the god of ecstasy and of deep communal ecstasy. He's also the god of Greek tragedy. And But he's a dangerous god. He is the irrational god, and if he is not approached with the appropriate ritual respect, he can be really an expression of who we are in our irrational responses to the world, and especially in a deeply rational scientific culture. His irrational exuberance and even violence is just below the surface. And I would suggest that in modern culture, and especially in American culture and myth, so we have repressed our own Dionysian nature to an extent perhaps more so than any culture in history. And we have, as a result, we've had to project that unacknowledged aspect of ourselves onto other people. Now, this is basic psychology, or at least basic depth psychology, or Jungian or archetypal psychology. What we cannot accept about ourselves, we repress into the darkness of our individual or collective or even national unconscious. And but it's always there. It does not go away. It does not die. The only way we can live with ourselves in such a repressed state is to project these unacknowledged parts of ourselves onto others. Now, in our long European heritage, our white European ancestors conveniently have the Jew within the culture and the Muslim on the outside of the culture for hundreds and hundreds of years, so as to project what I call the other upon them. Now, Dionysus, to go back to Greek myth for a second, Dionysus to me is an archetypal expression of what I call the other, which is this part of ourselves that is so fundamentally, importantly, crucially part of who we are, and yet, as I said, we cannot accept or bring to consciousness. And so we see this other in the demonized scapegoating and stereotyping that we project upon other people. Now, when our ancestors came to this culture, they found first of all, the Native Americans, whom they demonized as this kind of outer other, and within a few generations they had hundreds of thousands and eventually millions of black slaves in the culture, they projected Dionysian nature, especially upon African Americans, what our Puritan ancestors did was they repressed such great parts of themselves, in order to see the rest of who they were, they saw it in the Native Americans and in the African Americans. And what they projected, especially upon African Americans, was an inability to control your impulses, because our Puritan ancestors were so good at that, so repressed, so good at repressing their impulses, that they, when they saw the other in their culture, they saw the other as someone who could not do so. And this is the kind of Dionysian nature that we have projected upon African Americans. Mm-hmm. But the consequences, of course, have been very severe, because we have been living, modern people have been living a very small part of our capacity, of our human potential, because so much of it is repressed and projected outwards on other people. And what that means, I believe, in terms of our daily lives is fear. I think the most dominant emotion in American culture, especially in the last 10 years since 9/11, has been fear. But my book suggests that this is nothing new, that we have been doing this ever since 1700. For three centuries, Americans have been living in fear of the other. First, of this Native American, whom other from the outside, and later on of the Black American. And curiously enough, around the time 1875, just as the fear of the red, what I call the red outer other, was finally beginning to fade away from American consciousness, right exactly at that time, America discovered a new red other, and that was communism. So it was a kind of seamless shift during that period. And so for another 130 years or so, Americans lived in fear of communism until roughly 1990, when, of course, there was another seamless shift in our paranoid imagination, when fear of the Middle Eastern terrorist became our greatest our greatest emotional experience. And unfortunately, but we have to look at this realistically, you know, with open eyes, there have been elitist groups in our culture, economically and politically elitist groups, who have been profiting from our fear of the other and have been stoking our fear of the other continually throughout throughout American history. And of course, anybody who's sensitive and perceptive now can see what's going on, what went on throughout the Bush administration and is continuing now, this continually stoking of the fear of the other. Mm-hmm. And of course, the current expression of that is both terrorism and recent war talk about Iran, but also about the whole issue of immigration. You know, just to summarize this aspect of it, of the emotional question of how our mythology and our deep unconscious thinking about who we are, our identity of who we are as Americans, how it impacts us on the ground daily, individually and emotionally, is through fear.
Mm-hmm. We have a question from one of the chats. Are the fears being projected onto us as a way of control in a way like propaganda?
Oh, absolutely. That's not to say that... let me put it this way. Elites in all cultures, certainly in Nazi Germany, stoked fear of the other, so as to manipulate the population. But I think Americans have been doing this since the very beginning, the creation of our American story, I think the essence of American identity, or at least white American identity, and with that the notion of white privilege, has been intimately associated, connected with fear of the other. In other words, the whole notion of whiteness grew along with the notion of blackness and the notion of redness, and to a very great and profound extent, the notion of whiteness was dependent on the perception that white people were not blacks or reds. We were defined in terms of this fear. Elites do manipulate this fear. But the important thing to understand is that there's a kind of mythic substrate in our psyche as Americans that makes us particularly susceptible to this kind of manipulation.
Mm-hmm. That's really important. You know, as I was reading your book, I never had seen it quite this way before, but my growing up really drew my attention to this whole aspect. My father was a career military man, and I went to school with the kids of military people and lived on military bases. And in the military at that time, everyone was integrated. So my friends were of every nationality and every color. And then in the summertime, I would go and spend the summer in the Deep South in South Georgia, where my grandfather was an avid segregationist. We were not allowed to argue with him. Our mother said that we might give him a heart attack because we could not understand how he could be so alienated from people that we thought of as normal people because we were around them all the time, and also how our parents changed. They would socialize with people of all colors in the military, but then go be very provincial there. And there was a quality of meanness or mean-spiritedness that you also address in your book that seemed to go along with the separation that they wanted to keep in the Deep South.
Well, good points. You know, it is an interesting, there are so many paradoxes in American history and culture and contradictions. It is a notable thing that the military in many areas was much further advanced in integration than the rest of the culture, or at least the southern part of the culture. or at least after at least after the end of World War II, when the military itself became fully integrated.
Right.
And I do want to take 1 second here to point out, on the one hand, I certainly locate myself within a radical political tradition of Howard Zinn, who was nice enough to give me a blurb for my book, and Noam Chomsky, and so on. And I do feel that the American Empire is in many respects the worst aspect of our myth of innocence. On the other hand, I do not want to be criticized, anybody to sense that I'm feeling that I'm criticizing individual members of the military. You know, when you think in terms of archetypal images, one of those images is of the warrior, the warrior, in all cultures and in all mythologies, was someone who protected the realm. You know, he stood at the borders of the realm and protected the community from potential danger. Unfortunately, in modern culture, we have very few warriors. What we have is instead uninitiated heroes, who sadly are drawn to institutions like the military and the police. Because the better part of them would love to be warriors, but to become a true warrior then requires initiation, and without that you have a culture of death. As I mentioned earlier, with the gang cultures and many aspects of our military.
Yeah. Yes. Oh wow. There's just so much. I think we could talk for hours and hours and hours. And this is a big, big book too that you wrote.
I'd like to think that I'm conveying big ideas in plain English, and I really feel that anybody with a real concern for how we're living and how the culture is and what America is doing in the world would be able to understand what I'm talking about.
Well, I definitely, it struck home with me. There were a lot of things, and maybe following our break here, we can look at that. Like, one of the questions that's, you talk about through mythology, eating or killing our young, and how it is that we can have in our culture a person who simultaneously abhors abortion but supports capital punishment. And what mythology may have to do with that. This is something that I've dealt with. We need to take a break here. We're talking with author and ritualist Barry Spector. His book is Madness at the Gates of the City, The Myth of American Innocence, and he's at madnessatthegates.com if you want to know more about the book. Ask your questions now on the chat. Call us toll-free at 800-630-7858. And you're listening to Full Power Living. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.
Everybody feels anger. But if you don't learn to deal with it, anger can mess up your life. It can cause you relationship problems, difficulties on the job, or create health problems. If you want a way to understand and work with anger that's simple yet so powerful it helps you to put an end to the specific angers that are messing up your life, then you'll want to get a copy of a mini course I've created for you entitled Reduce Anger Now. With it, I want you to be able to figure out what's stimulating the anger you feel and have an easy way to change that anger so you can dramatically reduce the anger in your life. I'm Eileen Dillon, the Emotional Pro, longtime psychotherapist, coach, and anger expert. I've helped thousands of people to master anger, and I want you to begin to become an anger master in your life. Order Reduce Anger Now at the store, www.emotionalpro.com. That's www.emotionalpro.com.
We
We're back with award-winning author Barry Spector discussing the myth of American innocence. Be sure to check him out at madnessatthegates.com. That's his book. So Barry, before the break, you spend quite a bit of time drawing from mythology, the whole issue of killing or eating the children. And then you talk a lot about how we send our children off to war, how we don't protect our children from abuse, how we fund the military with far, far more money than we fund ways to take care of our children. And I just would like you to talk more about this notion of killing and eating our children and how that works in America.
Thank you. Yeah. This, in a sense, the notion, the myth, what I call the myth of the killing of the children, is perhaps the most profound myth at the very core of Western culture. But let me backtrack just a little here. As we were talking earlier about the three-part initiation sequence and the hero's journey and the whole issue of initiation, it is my imagination that indigenous cultures all across the world, and including our own indigenous ancestors, had fully functioning initiation rituals for thousands and thousands of generations. That process began to break down during biblical times, as some of the Greek stories even express that. And of course, throughout the growth of Western culture, we've had the progressive loss of those meaningful initiations. Now, in initiation, what happens is the symbolic killing of the child, so that an adult may emerge. There may be truly profound physical tests to be passed, and sometimes they are not successful. But what everyone understands is that there's a symbolic death happening. Now, when mythology breaks down in any culture across the world, and in some places you can see it happening within just a few generations, for example, in Africa, what happens is we begin to take our myths literally. In modern American culture, you can see this most starkly in fundamentalist religion, where people quite literally take these wonderful symbolic themes in the Bible and they break them down into quite literal understandings of things. And as far as initiation is concerned, what happens when we take our myth literally is we, instead of symbolically killing the children so that they may arise out of the ashes as adults, we literally kill them. We send them off to war. And perhaps World War One was the real turning point where mythology had been so broken down that the elders quite literally sent the young men off every day. In World War One, 7,000 young men were killed every single day. And that was just the beginning of the 20th century, and it's only gotten worse throughout the ensuing 90 years or so. So that, yeah, I believe that America now is sadly, but we must look at it with open eyes. America has been a culture where the underlying myth of the sacrifice of the children is our deepest secret. And in a sense, it's our most taboo subject, and because it's taboo, we won't speak about it. But it is there everywhere we look. We can see it in the millions of young men incarcerated We can see it in the poverty in our cities. We can see it in the breakdown of our educational system, where children are just simply pushed through a factory system of education. Instead of education, which means to bring something out that is unique in the person, what you have is instruction, which is pushing something into them. So that they can become, so that most of our young people become interchangeable cogs in a consumer society, and those that don't, don't make it are simply cast aside into the streets of the inner city. I mean, we've got hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of children living homeless in this culture. I mean, it's an absolute shame, and yet it is the perfect expression of who we are. When we think in terms of this myth of the killing of the children. But if you don't mind, can I ask how much time have we got left in the interview?
We have about 5 more minutes, yeah.
Okay, because I do not want to leave your listeners or my readers with the assumption that I'm simply trashing American culture.
Good, that was my next question.
If you don't mind, would you mind if I just say a few
Please.
Words about this? Yes, it is important for us to look with open eyes at who we are and who we've become and this tremendously diminished imagination of who we might be. And at the same time, it's critically important to acknowledge that for 300, maybe 400 years, people in every culture around the world have been perfectly aware of what the American Empire has been doing to the world. And yet, from every country in the world, people have always been and remain desperate to come here, to come to this culture, to come here and become Americans. And so that's an amazing paradox, isn't it? And the only way we can make sense of it, and we have to make sense of it, is that there's something beyond the simple, the superficial idea of coming to America for economic opportunity and getting rich. I think the idea of opportunity points us toward a deeper archetypal theme. And if we're able to, and we're going to have to, cook down the myth of American innocence down to its essential basic components. And when we do, and it may take many generations before we can really do it, but when we do, what we'll find in the American story is the most fundamental mythic image of all, and that is the idea of the new start, of the opportunity to drop the old and enter the initiatory fires and emerge in a new place as new people with a new potential to make a new future. So we're not going to lose the American myth simply by understanding it. We've had it for too long. It is part of who we are. What we need to do is go deeper into it. And if we go deeper into deeper enough into the stories of who we have been, and we discover and we begin to be able to learn the skills of thinking mythologically and thinking symbolically and thinking metaphorically, will begin to reframe the myth of American innocence into what you might think it's always been trying to become.
Yes. Well, along with that, just to follow up, you've done a mountain of research and pulling ideas together and looking at, so many aspects of our American culture. Your book is just rich with that. What is your biggest hope? What can people, we have to go deeper into the myths, but what is your hope from writing this? That people will back up and take another look? What is it?
Well, you could look at who we are in terms of the 12-step process, where the addict doesn't really begin to change until he or she reaches rock bottom. I think we as individuals and we as a culture are going to have to go there. And there are some of us who are going to have to be ready when the culture hits rock bottom to help create the containers and offer the rituals for people to begin to reimagine who they are. But in order to do that, we as a culture are going to have to spend a lot of time in the realms of grief and mourning. So with the intention of reaching a sense of forgiveness for who we are and who we've been to each other. And in that light, I'd like to point out that one of the things that my wife and I do, is, as you mentioned at the top of the hour, is we offer an annual Day of the Dead grief ritual, and we usually do it in the Berkeley area for those of you who are listening in the Bay Area. And let me just give an email. That would be barry@madnessatthegates.com for anybody in the Bay Area who'd like to get on our email list for these kind of events. So this is what I'm doing, and you know, this is what I'm hoping we can encourage in the culture. You know, I just got back from New Orleans, and that is a place where ritual is still alive in America, maybe the only place, and where people know how to do funerals, and they know how to celebrate. And one of the things I've learned from our West African teachers, Maladoma Somme in particular, is that people and cultures who cannot grieve are also people who cannot laugh, and that our laughter and our capacity for joy and for forgiveness is equal to our capacity to go into the dark parts of realms of who we are, and our capacity to mourn. So you know, to be a full human being, to take back the other into ourselves as individuals and as a culture, means to expand very widely our emotional life. You know, to get back mm-hmm. to your expertise.
Mm-hmm. That's definitely. I mean, certainly after 40 years of being a therapist, I can see that. I realize that taking a person into the dark places inside of themselves opens them up so that they can get to a place of far less fear and openness and joy. And that's a wonderful...
And I'm hoping that we can do that as a culture.
Culture, right. That's a wonderful possibility, I think, that you are opening up. Well, Barry, I just really got a lot out of reading your book, and it put a lot of things into place for me that hadn't gone into a place before, things that I hadn't quite understood so well. So I want to thank you for writing Madness at the Gates of the City, The Myth of American Innocence, and for all the work that you did and all the concern you have for us as a people and for our society. And thanks for being here with us on Full Power Living today.
And thanks for the excellent questions. It was a really good conversation, I think.
Great. Me too. I enjoyed it. All right. Next week, March 15th, we're talking with Alan Locos about patience and the art of peaceful living. This is a topic I need to learn more about, and I think it also follows today's discussion quite well. Join us live every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific or noon Eastern time for more powerful experiences on Full Power Living. Thank you, Paul Johnston of Fresh Talk Media, for being our wonderful producer. For now, I'm Eileen Dillon, your host, reminding you to pay attention not to what you want to overcome, but to what you want to become.
Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.
Hey, you, with a rhinestone dog collar. Between us dogs, I just convinced my human to upgrade to a new home with a 1,200-square-foot bathroom. I think she called it a yard. With Wells Fargo's 3% down mortgage option, my human realized a new home was within reach, and I only gave her puppy eyes once. Get your human to talk to a mortgage consultant or learn more at wellsfargo.com/woof.
Wells Fargo Home Mortgage. Down payments as low as 3% on a fixed-rate loan require mortgage insurance. Ask a home mortgage consultant about loan requirements. Wells Fargo Home Mortgage is a division of Wells Fargo Bank, N.A., Equal Housing Lender, NMLS ID 399801.